Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Varca with Andy Lipson, and this is part two with Will, a former naval officer and socialist. We had a discussion with him.
He's not a former socialist, though. He's a present-day socialist, former naval officer.
Former naval officer. So I should say socialist and former naval officer. Thank you.
That's fine.
This is good. We're speaking with Will, socialist and former naval officer, on part two of this discussion, where we will be delving into his military experience. Part one, for our listeners and viewers, can be checked out on a link below here on the description, and where we had discussed Will's personal political journey as he discovered what made politically sense for him as a socialist and his evolution there. And this time we will be delving into the nooks and crannies and all kinds of areas of former naval officer life and military experience in general. I think that we will find very fascinating, especially since it's an inside look, it's an insider's look. No? Yeah. Did you want to say anything, Andy?
No. Well, just to say that this interview is, I'm excited about this. I sent Will, I think, 18 questions, the range of, over a whole range of political questions I have about the military and just cultural questions. I think Eduardo shares some of those, but we may find ourselves even getting into questions of just sort of details of terminology, because I really don't know a lot about the military, and I really hope to use you, Will, as a way of educating myself and maybe others who are listening about some of the real basics that we just don't know.
Yeah.
So this might end up being a two-part interview, a three-parter. Will part one, you know, is coming, and Will part two is now. I wouldn't be surprised if we have Will part three. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
How are you?
Sounds good. And I'm doing well. It's cold here, but we got the heat on, so.
I interrupted you, Will. Did you want to say something beforehand? I'm sorry. There's a delay, so we're not realizing.
Yeah. I was just going to say thanks again for having me on again. Asking me to talk about my experiences in the military, it's like, you can imagine inviting a kid into a candy shop. It's kind of like that feeling. So it's, you know, it's like being able to talk about this, you know, it's kind of a rare opportunity because people usually aren't that interested. Like they might ask you like one question and, you know, I tend to over talk about it. So thank you again.
Oh man, I'm glad. Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, let's start from just the beginning, right? So you, in our first interview, you mentioned how you spent several years in the military, and it was what actually became a very crucial part of your process to discovering how radical your ideas were going to take you. Can you summarize for our listeners what role you had in the military, what branches specifically, and during what roles you had during that time and the amount of time you spent in these roles?
Yeah. Oh, and one more thing. I just want to thank my wife, Stacy, and the kids for giving me this time to talk with you guys.
Yeah, thank you.
I joined the Navy right out of high school in 2001. Basically took the summer off after graduating and then shipped off to boot camp. And that was August of 2001. And I enlisted, so I went to boot camp. Went through boot camp and then went to A school, where I was trained to be an electronic warfare technician. So this is the it's basically passive radar detection of electromagnetic radiation from ships or missiles. Or land-based radar, primarily with the purpose of threat detection, especially missiles. So I was an operator of the Slick 32, which is basically this ancient 1970s machine. I think it's been updated since I left, but basically the purpose is to detect missiles and secondarily to detect other ships' radars for intelligence purposes. So radar detection and then jamming is the other part that the Slick 32 does. So anyway, that's kind of what I did. It was a couple of months of school. We did a lot of memorizing signals and whatnot, so learning about radars. And but I was kind of like a button pusher. So I was going to work in the Combat Direction Center, most likely in the carrier, because that's where the capabilities are. So I ended up getting stationed on the Harry S. Truman, which is an aircraft carrier out of Norfolk, Virginia. And we did, after I got there, that was March of 02, and we did our training workups, as they're called, to get certified to deploy. Ended up deploying December of 2002, so that was, you know, my first deployment, that was Operation Iraqi Freedom. And we'll get more into that later, but so I was on Truman for 4 years, almost 4 years, and I did two deployments on that ship. I was in the Electronic Warfare Division, which, yeah, as I said, works in the Combat Direction Center of the carrier. And so, you know, it's like you see in the movies with people looking at radar screens and stuff like that. It just, you know, it's basically how it is, except a lot less exciting, a lot more boring. And I also worked in Flag Intel for a little bit, which was kind of the same thing. And then I worked in Strike Ops Admin, which was different. In that job, I was kind of like admin for the... So Strike Ops is basically like the nerve center for the air wing. So that's where all the pilots go in. They make their air plans. They plan their... they basically coordinate with each other when they're going to take off and land, and they make their air plans that way. And that was a really interesting job, because imagine being a fly on the wall in, with Navy pilots. You know, it was pretty cool. Especially for me at the time. I imagine right now it'd be, you know, with my values now, it'd be a little bit less cool, but at the time it was super cool. Next I got accepted on my second application, second year, to the Naval Academy. And I was there from 2005 to 2009 and graduated 2009. That's when Obama was there. I got to shake his hand when I was still a huge Obama fan. That was before he broke all his promises. I was an officer for 6 years. So my first ship after graduating was the USS Benfold, a guided missile destroyer and a ballistic missile defense destroyer, which means it was retrofitted with the capability to knock ballistic missiles out of the sky. So like nuclear ballistic missiles. So as Noam Chomsky says, this, you know, even though it's ballistic missile defense, it's actually widely understood as an offensive capability.
Yeah.
So on Benfold, I was the CIC officer, so the Combat Information Center, which is similar to the Combat Direction Center on the carrier, sort of like the tactical nerve center of the ship. And I was basically the admin in charge of the operations specialist. So that was my main job for 6 months, and then I went on to become the communications officer, which is in charge of the overall in charge of the networks, the computer networks, all radio communication networks, and encryption systems. So basically our ability to communicate internally and externally, hugely stressful job, and very busy. But I survived. I did that for 2 years. And it's probably the most frequently fired position, mainly because of the encryption stuff. And so I was very thankful that I managed to get through without getting fired. And then after that, I went to my second tour, my second C tour. And I hope I'm not confusing you guys. I'm trying not to spend too much time on this. But.
No, this is good. And honestly, already, I think we're going to be asking some questions about some of these nitty-gritties that aren't about this. Because as you speak, a lot of detailed questions I have that I think we need to get to. We may not get to some of the political stuff this time. We'll see.
Yeah, that's all right.
Keep going.
Yeah. So my next C tour, because you normally do, at least at the time, you did basically one long first C tour and then a shorter second C tour, and then you transitioned to shore duty. So my next ship was a minesweeper. And since we did crew rotation, instead of being assigned to a ship, you were assigned to a crew, because some of the minesweeps are out in the Persian Gulf, stationed in Bahrain. Some of them are here, so basically you rotate out when you deploy. Anyway, so I was assigned to MCM Crew Reaper.
Can you give us years?
And I was
not
the damage controller.
Dates, just years, more or less?
Oh, sure, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so that would have been, so I left Benfold probably December 2011 and went to DCA school to learn how to fight fires and stuff. And I probably reported like April of 2012 to MCM Crew Reaper. And I would say in that transition time is when I read Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn. So just keep that in mind. So reporting to Crew Reaper as a damage control assistant who is in charge. MCMs are very, minesweepers are very small ships, so very small crew. And I only had 4 people, whereas when I was communications officer, I had 20 people. And DCA, basically in charge of damage control, which is, you know, fighting fires or structural damage. I also was the gas-free engineering officer, so if there's like some kind of toxic gas, that was my responsibility as well. And then after I survived that one, I didn't get fired. And I was reported to shore duty at Commander Naval Surface Forces Pacific, who is also Naval Surface Forces. So SURF-4 and SURF-PAC are actually the same person. So basically the guy in charge of all ships in the Navy, and the personnel, obviously, that was my boss, but I was, you know, his staff consists of hundreds of people. So I was sort of one person in this gigantic bureaucracy, out in Coronado. I didn't mention Benfold was in, Benfold and Crew Reaper are both in San Diego. So after I graduated, I went to the West Coast with my wife. Her family's in California, so that was a better, more convenient location for us. So I did 2 years in the Admiral Staff, and I was in the maintenance division. So basically I was in charge of amphibious ships, maintenance overhaul periods. And so I would kind of, coordinate, major repairs and stuff like that. At least on paper, that was my job. So yeah. And then I got out in 2015. I left active duty and then I was in the reserves for a little bit, but that's pretty much negligible because it's 1 weekend a month and it's, you know, it's it's not really, it's so far removed from anything substantive, I guess.
So can I go?
We're gonna
do different basic questions, and they might be different. The first ones I'm gonna ask are, and I think I asked this earlier, but I'll ask you to spell it out. I'm not as familiar with the terms of the terms of private and corporal, and the like. That's as much as I'm familiar with the various grades of people who are, and I think that's in the Army. Can you speak to what those what your grades were within the Navy? And just give me a little education about how, you know, the different terms. It's like white belt, blue belt, kind of thing like
right.
that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I, first enlisted, I in graduated boot camp, I was a, seaman recruit. So, that's E1. So all the branches basically have E1 through E9 and O1 through, I think, O9. Actually, I think it goes higher. I can't remember. I should remember this, but it's been a while now. So, you know, I've forgotten what the Army and Marines and Air Force are, but in the Navy, it starts with E1 is seaman recruit, E2 is seaman apprentice, E3 is seaman, and then you go up to petty officer third class, and you get your crow, they call it. And then petty officer second class, petty officer first class, and then you go to chief, so chief petty officer, and then it goes senior chief petty officer, then master chief petty officer. And then after that, there's also warrant officers, we'll skip that, but then O1 would be ensign, which is what I became when I graduated in the Naval Academy. Next would be lieutenant junior grade, and then lieutenant, which was what my rank when I left, it was an O3.
Okay. Do you know what that E stands for?
Yeah, so...
Because O sounds like it stands for officer.
Enlisted.
Oh, okay.
Right. Enlisted, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can ask a question. Yeah, I wanted to know, you had a lot of experience in, it seems like, in the Department of Technology, right? Did you, at that time, were they already... Because
yeah.
I know, during the years of Obama, it was very well known that he started sort of the years of the drone operations. Did you all have any, mm-hmm. what was it, the relationship that you as an, your branch had with the drones?
That's a good question. We didn't have too much direct interaction. I think the only thing that I can recall, I think that was mostly Air Force with the drones, mm-hmm. You know, flying drones from wherever, Colorado, you know, while bombing people in Iraq, kind of mind blowing. But yeah, so I think we did like some experimental landings and takeoffs on our destroyer, but that was the extent of our involvement with drone technology. I think I can't remember anything else. That I don't recall anything on the carrier, but you know, there's a lot that you're not aware of as an enlisted sailor. Mm. And a lot of times, even as an officer, you just kind of like, you only have your lane and you stay in your lane and get your job done. And you don't really pay too much attention to the big picture.
Yeah. Yeah.
And another question I'd have, so I'd like to go through some of those. I can really get a picture because you said, like you mentioned the movie of the radar, looking at a radar screen and things like that. But then your next, the job you had at Ben Fold, which was anti-ballistic defense.
Yeah.
First of all, could you say more about what that job would look like?
Yeah.
And secondly, I think it's a big statement, and I think it's true, to recognize that anti-ballistic defense is offensive. But can you say more about why you know and why even the military knows that anti-ballistic defense is actually not it's an offensive measure, not a defensive measure per se, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, so I'm not the greatest in sort of military analysis, but I think, you know, basically it's understood that ballistic missile defense is considered offensive because you know, countries like Iran, they have their entire military is a very defensive military. It's not designed to invade other countries, and so. When countries like that develop ballistic missile capabilities, they're doing it as a deterrent against attacks by the United States or some other country. And so if you're basically neutralizing their deterrent capability, then that's, basically you're signaling, you know, dominance over them. Because, you know, I can't think of a good analogy, but yeah, you're neutralizing their deterrent capabilities.
Which then opens up, which basically says to the person who's the aggressor, we are in a better position to be aggressive now because we don't have to worry about your one form of offense that we have to worry about.
Right, right. Especially for a country like the United States that we have, you know, our policy is one of power projection and we're very clearly oriented towards asserting dominance across the entire world. So it's for us, you know, to claim that anything is a defensive measure, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, if it's defensive, then why are we sending them all to the other side of the world? Well, the claim is that we're defending allied nations, but,
right,
you know, it's...
Like the, yeah. This is what we say about North Korea as well. We put anti-ballistic missiles in South Korea, but we say it's about defense, but it seems to allow us to go on the offense with regards to North Korea.
Right. Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about what your job would have been there then? Like, what's that look like? What are you doing on Benfolds?
So we had a lot of different equipment. I guess the first thing would be just the computer networks, and that was the biggest headache of all. But probably the more important stuff was, you know, it's been so long now, but basically the things that allowed us to conduct things like BMD, and a lot of that was transparent, opaque.
What's BMD?
Yeah.
Ballistic missile defense.
That's ballistic missile defense. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
It's Veterans Day weekend.
Yes, Veterans Day.
Andy's here. So PJs.
Go ahead, sorry.
Go ahead. We're slow.
Yeah. So I would say that the BMD part was, it was kind of opaque to us because basically as long as we ensured that that equipment was up and running and, you know, the green lights were all on, we weren't too involved with what was being transmitted across that, you know, that channel. Our job was to make sure that channel was, you know, maintained. And it was our fault if they couldn't communicate. And, you know, we, it was a big deal if they lost that signal. Yeah, it's very advanced technology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've heard of the Patriot missile system. That's pretty much the only one I know about. Is this the same system or it's a different system?
The Patriot missile, I believe. Oh man, I had to look that up. I want to say that's an anti-air. Yeah, I can't remember.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Then can we go to the next job? Yeah. I know you mentioned was in a different ship around encryption.
Yeah, yeah.
And you said that job.
Yeah, so that encryption.
So you said that job was particularly stressful and one easily to be gotten fired of, or easy to get fired for effing it up, I guess. Well, first of all, what does that job entail? And what, all these jobs don't seem so, they seem, could be stressful. Can you say more about what that position looked like for you when you were doing it?
Yeah, so that job, basically encryption, it basically, we would maintain the encryption keys. It's hard for me to explain it, but we kept everything in the vault. And I had required a clearance, and, you know, and the thing that gets you fired is, you know, possible compromise of classified information. There's top secret keys, there are secret keys, confidential keys, But just like the way that we broke the German code in World War II with the Enigma machine or whatever it was, so that sort of thing, if one of our key encryption keys becomes compromised, that's a huge deal, and that's why people get fired from this job. And so there was a lot of work just involved with maintaining the inventory and very just administrative, stuff, a lot of administrative work to download all the keys, and sometimes they were physical keys, so you had like actual rolls of paper with hole punch tape. Those got phased out eventually, but we still had some when I took the job. Now that it's all electronic, it's a lot easier, but you can still screw it up.
The thing that comes across really is the stay in your lane element of these jobs, where in a sense, it's like you're like a line worker that doesn't see the part before you and the part after you. And they like, and it seems like things are designed that way for people who are working on the base. You are working on an assembly line, but it's important that each person does their job right, but kind of you can't know what came before, and it seems like you're not supposed to know what came after. That's the impression I get.
Absolutely, yeah. I can't help but but think that that's deliberate. I mean, it has to be. Now, obviously, just from a security standpoint, it's the possibility of compromise is greater if the more people know about it. So that's why you have the whole need to know thing. So nobody knows something unless they need to know it. And that's true, not just for classified stuff, but just anything that, because anything that happens on the ship is basically sensitive information. So they have a saying, loose lips sink ships. So that's the mentality, is just kind of stay in your lane, especially in those jobs. Like, when it comes to like engineering, where it's all just, turning wrenches and maintaining the engines, that's different because you're not really privy to any of the more sensitive stuff, really. I mean, that stuff can get sensitive too, but yeah. It's definitely like a culture of, need to know.
And do you know at what officer level people start to see the bigger picture, start to see how all these pieces come into play? Where would the person need to be able to start to see it and to start to make decisions? Or, well, it's the commander in chief. It's still the president and all that stuff. But within the military, when do people start to see the bigger picture, so that they can start to say, well, we need to do that versus this?
I think if you're curious and you're willing to look, then you could start seeing things, and you know who to talk to and you're social, that sort of thing. You could start seeing things as an enlisted person. You just have to, obviously you don't want to go asking too many questions, but yeah, I mean, most people just don't even care. But if you wanted to, especially if you're in the operations department, where you're rubbing shoulders with a lot of those people who have information, then. But I'd say it's easier. Obviously it's easier as you go up in the ranks. So beginning with the division officer, you have a much better picture of what's happening. The captain and XO and department heads, they need you to have a picture of what's happening, because you need to know the ship's priorities. You need to know, but you just need to know the ship's schedule. You need to know what's important, what's not important, based on what the ship is doing. So as a junior officer, you have a really good picture. But I think it's hard once you get outside the ship to understand what's going on. But maybe department heads probably have a better understanding of, the broad, much bigger picture. But on that, I don't know if we're going to come to this later, but I want to be sure to mention 2009 Tomahawk strike on Yemen. Because, you know, speaking of things that, yeah, thinking things that you're not supposed to know, I think this would be one of them. Mm-hmm. So do you guys want to talk about that now, or?
What do you think?
Would it be, let's see, how about we get to it? I'm going to write a note for myself here, and I'm going to say 2009.
Yeah.
You just, Will, if you can, just let's go back a little bit, just to trace back on you personally before we go into the military again. Why did you choose the Navy?
Yeah, just because they were the first people to call me, honestly. So I took the ASVAB. I don't know if you guys, I don't even remember what it stands for. Did you guys take the ASVAB? I'm sure you've had to administer it in school as teachers.
Not you, maybe.
Or maybe not. Okay, well, so it's Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery test, and they call it a vocational, you know, but it's really for the military. So we took that in high school. We were required to take it. I don't know if that's still the case, but we had to take it. I did well on it, and the recruiter called me to tell me I did well and asked me if I was interested in joining. And I said I hadn't even really considered it up to that point, but when he asked me, it was like I decided right then and there, yeah, that's what I want to do. And I told my mom when she got home, and she was like, she was against it at first, like dead against it. And, because she grew up during the 70s, in the wake of Vietnam, and there was just, you know, a lot of anti-militarism, you know, still in the culture, which, you know, obviously I think that's still there now. But, you know, the recruiter came to our house to kind of reassure her, you know, but I think the key thing that he said was, it's not your father's Navy. And he set her mind at ease. And
that's what they think.
I think the thing for me was that I've always done, you know, I've played sports in high school. I've enjoyed doing choir and stuff like that, and I've always wanted to be part of something. I've always enjoyed being part of something, and so I think what I hated about school was just I didn't want to go to college anymore, I didn't want to go to college at all. And the appeal of the military was being part of something bigger than myself. That's something you hear a lot. Mm-hmm. Too, in addition to the economic piece, people want to be part of something that they think is important, and that was the case for me. Wanting to feel needed, to feel wanted, that was, you know, it just, it felt like it was a no-brainer for me at that point. And my grandpa was in the Marines, and so I was always proud of that he was in the Marines during World War II. So, you know, I was just, like I said, I believed in the sort of patriotic mythology of the United States. So yeah. And the Navy, I like the water. I just kind of like the sort of the popular image of the Navy. I guess very vague understanding. I didn't really have any real understanding of what the Navy was, but I like the ocean, the romance of being at sea. Mm-hmm. So.
You mentioned that it was also part of in the last interview, you had said that you had lacked focus as well. You weren't doing really well in school at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was weird too, because once I joined the Navy, because I entered the delayed enlistment program, so I, at the end of my junior year in high school, I signed up with the understanding that I'd shipped to boot camp in a year. And It was weird because once I joined the Navy, then I started doing well in school. I can't explain that. I don't have an explanation, but like I started doing my homework. I think it was because I knew I had to graduate. So I didn't want to risk not graduating because you had to have a diploma. I think that's what it was. But yeah, I just hated school. I hated homework. That's actually why I didn't go to become a nuke. We call it a nuke, but basically, the people who run the reactors on carriers and submarines. I didn't want to go to school for 2 years because I was fed up with school. So yeah.
I guess I do want to highlight something you said about wanting to be part of something, and particularly in relationship to public education, because we as your teachers are grading you as an individual. We ask you
right.
to, we assess you as an individual, even though capitalism will socialize you, make you a part of a social unit called the working class. Even the military will have you be part of a social unit, which is, and again, I only know the army parlance of platoon and things like that. And people often fight to save their group, not because of the cause per se. And it's really striking to me that is one of the things that is such a problem for young people in education, is it's so atomized. All the burden falls on them to essentially fight for your own future against your other classmates, particularly if I'm grading you on a curve. It's very interesting to me how I listen to that. And we in education, because it's capitalist education, I think it's intentionally atomizing, and even though we know we're preparing you for a collective future.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. It's just very alienating experience growing up as a kid in the post World War II U.S., where the suburbia, kids hardly even have an extended family anymore. Even you got your parents and maybe your little circle of friends, but so the attraction of having that family in the military, even if it's a toxic family, is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that right there is leading me into, I was thinking about this earlier, why the value of having an organized left that can serve as a community. And not as sort of a even more toxic community, like kind of a church, I guess.
I have a question about the culture. What, just in general, before I get to specifics, because I do have specifics, but just in general, what is the culture, the military culture, or specifically the naval culture?
Well, I guess it depends on where you're looking. Man, that's a big question. I mean, it's very diverse. It's basically just working class kids that are joining. So I would say, you take the culture of the working class, and it's very reflective of that. Although I would say that people are sort of kind of indoctrinated with a conservative mentality, very vaguely conservative mentality. You have people of color, you have black people, you have Filipinos, Mexicans. I would say, in my experience, fewer Mexicans, but a lot of Filipinos. And it's just very diverse. I mean, you get all kinds of opinions. I would say it's almost like a requirement that you, if you do talk politics at all, you have to be conservative. It's like, I don't really understand it. I guess that's because, maybe because it's the politics of the officers, so you don't want to say anything that runs counter to that, or maybe it just makes your job easier if you're conservative. But there's definitely sort of a cult of exceptionalism where we think that we have a higher, better values than sort of the civilian culture, I guess. But that's kind of vague too. I mean, I guess it's kind of difficult to generalize about the culture. I mean, when you get into the officer class, you can make some more specific statements, because I think that they are overwhelmingly conservative. There's some variation, like you might have like traditional Republicans or right-wing libertarians. One of my captains was a right-wing libertarian type, but he was also, like, his dad was Mexican. He was very working class and prior enlisted. So he and I would get into debates about stuff. And I think there was a lot of inner conflict, politically for him, because, you know, he had that background that kind of conflicted with his ideology of choice. But yeah, anyways.
So I think there are assumptions, particularly those of us on the left in a liberal city, there are assumptions we have about either the attitudes or actions in areas of, say, racism, of sexism, of homophobia,
yeah,
and even like anti-Muslim sentiment or
yeah
actions. Can you speak to what you saw or heard in the relationship to those that are in line with what I think are stereotypes or that are not? So
I think a lot of it is just reflective of society at large. And I don't know how much I could say is really greater than society, but maybe misogyny, I would say, is probably greater, for whatever reason. It's hard to say why, but I do think misogyny is worse in the Navy. I'll touch on the sexual assault and sexual harassment piece, because that ties into the misogyny, but I would say racism for sure. One thing that I heard friends, white friends, say pretty frequently was, the Navy made me racist. And I don't think it's true the Navy made them racist, obviously. I think it's more that they were never required to live in contact, in close contact, and work with people of color, before the Navy, and they just, they had these sort of perceptions and beliefs in the back of their mind before, and they just kind of came to the fore once they had to work with these people. And so, yeah, I would say racism is definitely there, as it is with society at large. I think it just becomes more pronounced because people have to work together. And so you're either, you know, you either get over it completely and or you sort of become more committed to it, I guess. Homophobia, that's an interesting question, because I don't think I saw it that much. I know in my division, we had kind of a strange culture where, like, I don't know how it began or who it began with, but people would, like, push each other's limits, like comfort limits, to see, like, you know, how homophobic are you? And, like, so you're, like, putting your arm around somebody and, like, watch them be uncomfortable, you know, like, and, you know, it was, like, it started off as, like, a joke, but then I think it was also partly a desire to, like, have a sense of not sexual intimacy, but, like, like a close friendship with each other, because, you know, you spend months at a time with these people and you never see land. And there was nothing sexual that I'm aware of, but there was definitely like sort of the cuddling, kind of male cuddling thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was funny to watch. What's that?
Camaraderie, is that how you say it?
Yeah, camaraderie,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, but cuddling is also a physical term for,
yeah,
like the not just camaraderie, but a camaraderie that wants to be institutionalized through physical contact. It's very interesting to hear it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know how often that happens, but I would imagine that it happens fairly often. I would guess that that wasn't unique to my division. Because I saw it elsewhere too. in my other ships. But so that was interesting. And it was fun to watch new people come into the division and be completely creeped out at first by this behavior, and then eventually kind of like settle into it and become comfortable with it. So I guess that's just a interesting thing about homophobia in the Navy, at least. I don't know what it's like in the Marines or Army. As far as Islamophobia, being anti-Muslim, I would say that's definitely there. I mean, it's sort of like almost requisite, I guess, to have people say stuff without really even thinking about it. And so, like, people might say words like raghead or something, just almost as if it means the same thing as Muslim, like, without even thinking about it. And there are very few Muslims in the military, at least when I was in. I wonder why. I would say in most cases, these things are almost like just subconscious and default, But yeah, I would say there's a fair amount of bigotry. I don't know how much there is compared with society at large. It's hard to say.
When you enlist, do you have to talk about your politics? Do you have to talk about your politics before you enlist? You said that it's not in, that normally people have conservative views, but if you have anything outside of conservative views, you're sort of seen as maybe too radical, maybe you're saying. Is that it? How do people know about your political ideology? How is that sorted out? I wonder how they filter that out. I mean, I'm sure they're not, I saw your head shake, that maybe they're not asking you about your political ideology when you enlist, but how is it that most people have these conservative views?
I think joining the military is probably just generally a more conservative thing to do. You get people who like hunting and stuff, so they like the idea of shooting guns and whatnot, so they're more interested in that kind of thing, generally tend to be more conservative. And I don't know, I guess you kind of, it's, I guess, I don't know. I mean, one thing that's true is like we had Fox News on in the Combat Direction Center on, so 24/7.
Jesus.
So you get this stuff blasted into your ear, you don't know anything else really. And the officers generally tend to be conservative. I mean, the whole mission of the military is kind of just, it's more amenable to conservative beliefs, and there would just be a lot more cognitive dissonance if you're more liberal.
And if you did have, sort of a, maybe a radical point of view, were you seen as a dissident?
Yeah.
Were you possibly maybe marked?
Yeah.
As maybe not moving up the ranks?
Well, maybe. I mean, it would definitely cause problems. I never really saw anybody get into political debates. I can't think of much later. The one time that I was kind of like asked about politics was when I was going, I was doing an interview with the, I guess it was the FBI for my clearance, my security clearance when I was enlisted, and they asked me about my family, my Cuban family. Asked me if I had any contacts with my Cuban family, and I didn't. But that was interesting. So that was I think that was the one time that I had any. Well, throughout that entire interview, they ask you a lot about your political beliefs.
This is what I wanted to know. Yeah,
but
this
it's more
good to know. Yeah,
yeah. It's more like it's not like do you vote liberal or Republican.
Right.
It's more like Do you advocate the violent armed overthrow of the U.S. government? Like, or, you know,
yeah,
like, have you ever
that's what
advocated
I'm
that?
trying to get at. Yeah,
it's like,
not if you're for Hillary or something. Yeah, it's yeah.
No, yeah. No, I think there probably are a lot of liberals in the military that just keep their mouths shut, because, you know, people talk about bleeding heart liberals, and you don't want to be seen as a sort of like bleeding heart, vulnerable, like snowflake person. So I think people kind of adopt a conservative, like tough guy persona just to, so that they can be seen as reliable and appropriately callous, and you know, because being callous is something that it's easier to do your job if you're, you know, emotionally callous and lacking in compassion. So it's almost like a value in the military to not care about anybody but your own comrades.
Yeah.
To have any kind of scruples about what you're doing. And it's all over the movies. If you go back and watch like these movies, they definitely they drag you the hippie image through the mud. The kind of people that, you know, protest any kind of military intervention. It's just it's such a huge part of American culture. You know, the idea that veterans came back from Vietnam and were spat upon by hippies, which is a complete myth. That's such a hugely persuasive mythology. So people, you know, I guess American culture in general is just conservative, I guess.
I mean, I know we're going to get to that one, the question around sexual assault.
No, not yet. I still have two more questions before I get there.
But I actually think that the military, because it does sound like the question that they're asking you of, would you call for the armed overthrow of, that's the question they need to know.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to vote Democrat or Republican, it's fine, dude.
Right.
You're
exactly
right in the game. Because we know Democrats make more war than Republicans, you know. They just, but they're more true believers on bringing democracy. Republicans often are like, no, we're just getting your oil. And so it actually makes sense that they make an important distinction, because there was a time when there were soldiers, and it was during the end of the Vietnam War, where soldiers did start to call for the armed overthrow of, you know, at least would speak of it, and they would fraternize with the enemy in doing so. So I think they're right on target with the question that they need to ask, it seems to me.
I have another question. You said that what were the demographics like normally? Was it mostly white, or was it there were a very mix of people of color in the Navy?
It's hard to say. I would say the
Your
officer
perception.
Ranks are definitely whiter,
mm-hmm.
But enlisted ranks are far more diverse.
And women? Were there women in the Navy?
Yes. I imagine that number is rising, but it's also limited by things like the way the ships are built, because you have separate berthings or living spaces and separate bathroom facilities. So there's physical limitations. But I think the number is like around 20%, which might be lower when you get to actual ships. Because most people try to avoid sea duty if possible. And, I don't know the specific statistics as far as the diversity, though.
All right. And and the Navy has been known historically for having putting limitations on people of color, racist limitations for moving up the ranks. Did you see that blatantly happened at all?
I saw informal ways that I saw informal limitations, so maybe like not deliberate. For example, we had one black member of our division who was talented, and he was a hard charger, so he was motivated, and at one point he got put in charge of it was something super mundane, like birthing cleaners, but he was kind of assigned supervisory responsibility for a task, and the guys that he was put in charge of were white. And I mean, nobody likes having one of their peers put in charge of them. So there's always going to be some degree of, you know, rebellion, I guess. But for him, it felt like it was much more than it would have been for a white person. They were just really, really giving him a hard time and basically refusing to do what he said, just doing the opposite of what he said. And so I think that sort of thing happens pretty frequently. There's an admiral, Admiral Pons, who's a black admiral, and that's pretty rare, obviously.
Yeah, so,
I mean, obviously your popularity is a huge part of whether you get promoted or not, because, like, you know, the people below you have a huge degree of control over your fate. If they want to make your career a failure, they can. And so for people of color and for women, too, who are put in supervisory roles, I would say it's a lot harder for them to do well, just because of, you know, people rebel more than they would a white male, I guess. Yeah, so I would say I never saw anything like that I could definitely point to as like this person got promoted because of this, but you definitely see those informal kind of limitations where the general culture creates this sort of system of white supremacy or patriarchy.
I guess I have a question in relationship to that, because I know two of the people who, or some of the people I've known in our JROTC program were officers.
JROTC program.
Junior officer, damn, I don't know what it is. Junior reserve, yeah. Junior reserve officer training corps, something like that, right?
Awesome.
Yeah.
So,
and actually all of them are men of color, and in some ways they all recognize the racism that's in society, but often speak of their time in the military as maybe less racist than their time outside of it. So one of the questions I'd have about that example is when the white seamen or people underneath this officer gave him hell, did the upper echelon support the officer and basically force people to get their minds right, or did they just stay hands off and let the guy suffer in that?
Well, it wasn't really too overt, and I think my LPO was Puerto Rican, and my LCPO, his supervisor was, sorry, I'm throwing acronyms out there again, the leading petty officer was the E6 in charge of our division. He's Puerto Rican, and his supervisor, the leading chief petty officer, is from Guam. And there was no real resolution to that. It just kind of like, I don't know how much it determined his trajectory. He went on to become a recruiter and stuff, but he got high marks, I think. But yeah, there wasn't much of a reaction. I mean, people tend to avoid dealing with stuff like that just because it's so, I mean, if you raise the equal opportunity flag, then there's a whole, you know, bureaucracy that to deal with that. So people try to avoid, you know, at all costs to raise that flag, I guess.
And will sleep deprivation, I've read a lot about that. The Navy specifically is known for keeping people very sleep deprived, and which is part of the reason there were actually some accidents that happened recently with some of the ships, because it is said that the Navy doesn't really allow for workers, or the, as you see them, seamen, to have proper sleep.
Oh, that's interesting that that's being said. I mean, that's absolutely true. And it just boggles my mind when these accidents happen, is because there have been a lot of ship collisions in the past several years. And it's getting really serious collisions. And it's quite obvious for anybody who's been on these ships as to why they're happening. And that's exactly what you said, sleep deprivation. And I would be interested to see that article because I guess I just haven't come across it. And when you look at the sort of the Navy's response to these things, it's like they're going to investigate. It's like you don't need that much of an investigation. Like we should know by now what's going on. Basically these ships are getting kind of overloaded with missions. So you've got all kinds of different capabilities that they want to have on paper for the combatant commander, so the combatant commander can say, oh, I want to do X, Y, Z. And so you end up having to jump through all these hoops to get certified in I don't know how many different mission areas. And you have to do like, there's just so much bureaucracy required for getting certified in these mission areas. And you just end up being so busy. There's never any rest. And the people who are driving these ships, mainly the division officers, which is what I was, the people who stand officer of the deck, they're falling asleep on watch because. Or not adequately preparing for watch because they have so many responsibilities, so many administrative responsibilities, and the watch rotation it's an anachronism going back to the whole like tough guy thing, the idea that we're supermen who should be able to stay up working all day and then stand as 5 hour watch at night. Yeah, it's ridiculous. We have science that says otherwise, but just the culture hasn't really caught up. Because I stood officer of the deck on both my shifts as an officer, and some nights it was hard to stay awake. And I had friends that would, take turns sleeping on watch, and sometimes they get caught, sometimes they didn't. But it's extremely dangerous. Even if you're not asleep, you're dim-witted, and even if you're just struggling to stay awake, you're not going to be as alert as you need to be. And I'd be sitting up there guzzling coffee and still falling asleep. So it's crazy. Yeah, and the captains are just. I don't know why they don't. It's like they forget what it's like. Or I don't know what it is. But everybody, like I said last talk, if you're not a yes man, you don't get promoted. So, that's why these ships get overloaded, because everyone is just keeps saying yes. And nobody's willing to say no. Like, we have too much. We can't do this because it's not safe. And it's like, where do you draw the line? It's a spectrum. But I mean, I guess all that is really secondary to the entire mission of the military. So I guess it's good in the big picture that these ships are falling apart and getting destroyed. But from an internal perspective, it's irrational. But I think that just speaks to the bureaucracy and the hierarchy.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think we're going to go with three parts, to be honest. So we're just going to have to deal with that. Because the thing I would say is what you're describing reminds me very much of what's happening in education. More and more responsibilities falling on the same number of people, or sometimes fewer number of people. This conditions of overwork, the conditions of overwhelmed. Your job as a person, as a essentially a grunt within the military is no different than the position of a grunt within under capitalism, which is you're going to get overworked, and they just need you to do enough. And if when you get used up, they'll find somebody else.
Yeah, exactly.
And the thing that's interesting to me is we haven't. I guess I want to ask you about things like pay and benefits in relationship to some of this stuff, because I know that's been there's been a lot of talk about how it's very low. But can you speak to that part of this, you know, of being exploited essentially?
We're never going to get to any.
Yeah,
we have lots of questions for you, Will.
Because we will end with this. I want to get. We'll probably end with the sexual, like the sexual assault thing, because I think it's important. But we're going to have to come back to some other, even bigger questions that we have. You know, so.
Yeah. So the pay and benefits. I would say pay and benefits are generally pretty good, and you know, you get full coverage, medical, dental. It's really good, and especially when you get higher in the ranks and officers, it's great. You know, it's I mean, I guess when you factor in, you know, how much are you getting paid by the hour, then it might be a little bit less than it seems because you're spending, you know, so much time out to sea and so much time on the ship, but it's, you know, just as far as job security and the pay and benefits, it's, you know, hard to beat, honestly. Mm-hmm. Especially for the Navy, because there's, you know, there's no risks. You're not really going to get PTSD in the Navy because you're not face to face with the people you're killing. You know, you have a better chance of dying on the driving to work on the freeway than you do.
Yeah.
In the Navy.
Are you able to kind of speak to some of the numbers of these things for, like, in terms of salary?
Oh, like,
So for example, but again, we have to still pay for our own room and board. I think yours is paid for already, but starting pay for teachers around 45,000, generally work your way up to around 80,000. Sometimes if, at the very top rate, 100,000, you know, things like that. So what are we talking about with the enlisted?
I can't even remember. I will say that, you know, E1 through E5 struggle financially. You know, especially if you have a lot of dependents, if your parents depend on you, or if you have kids, then, you know, it's definitely a struggle. But I don't think I could speak to the numbers too well.
Right. All right. I have questions about flats and hazing. I've heard a lot about this culture of flats within military culture. Can you speak to that? And even just freshmen that come on in, they haze.
Right.
Them.
Okay. Yeah. So hazing. Hazing is a big part of the military culture. I mean, boot camp is hazing in a lot of ways. You know, I mean, they say that the justification for the high pace of the training is, you know, a lack of time, but it's really just sort of a way of making you suffer and seeing how much you can take, and just ritual suffering, I guess. But I would say once you get out of boot camp, hazing, it's a lot better than what it used to be. You know, I think it's a lot less frequent. You'll have these crazy incidents where people like will ceremonially beat up somebody. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing just doesn't happen anymore. Or if it does, it's extremely rare. I think there was like one or two incidents on the ships that I was on, but again, it's rare. But like in boot camp, it was still in recent memory that the drill instructors could hit you. When I was there, it had been fairly recently abolished, I guess. But instead, they would basically exercise you until you were, you know, you couldn't move anymore. So there weren't any limits as far as, like, they could make you do as many push-ups as they wanted until you collapsed. They would, you know, they would Like one of the threats they would make is, we're going to make it rain, and basically that would be like, I'm going to PT everybody until there's so much sweat in the room that it's dripping off the ceiling. So, I mean, that's definitely very different from actually hitting somebody, because all you got to do is collapse to the floor, and it's like, what are they going to do? They can't do anything. But there's definitely like verbal humiliation, which, I think the idea is to kind of like make you callous and impervious to someone saying things. But of course, that's, you know, it's gonna hurt, especially at first when you're not used to it. But eventually you learn that it's all an act, and you just have to play your part in the play, I guess. Lots of cursing and humiliation, collective punishment. Sleep deprivation is a big part of it. When I was there, I think it's changed now, but we only got 6 hours of sleep a night, which seems okay, but when you accumulate that much sleep deprivation, it does things to your body. And you're not learning as much as you could be. Like, we would be going to classes and have to stand up because we couldn't sit there and not fall asleep. I would go through my trainee notebook and just find like scribble that I couldn't read because I was trying to stay awake while I was writing. So I mean, anyway, the hazing is just kind of like a part of the culture, but I would say it's more ceremony now. And even in boot camp, I think it's going away. So that part is thankfully changing. You know, I remember seeing on TV, like, people would like, when people would get like their flight pins, they would get basically punched into their chest so that the sharp part would go into their skin. That sort of thing doesn't really happen anymore. At least to my knowledge, I never saw it happen. I think somebody tried to do it to me once, and I just said, no, I don't want to do that. It was like an optional thing. But I mean, it makes you feel tough when you survive, when you get through it. So when I graduated boot camp, I felt like a new person. I felt like more disciplined and like a Superman almost. And I think that kind of mentality is dangerous, because you end up feeling better than everybody else because you've gone through this. And I think that sort of thing happens in other places. Like, my dad, he's a doctor, and he went to medical school, and I think a lot of the things that they did in medical school were basically a form of hazing, you know, the sleep deprivation thing. So I think it's just a way of making members of the club more special than everybody else.
You know, I ask these questions because there is also this, now after the Me Too movement, sort of people coming out to talk about their experiences. I mean, the Me Too movement deals specifically to sexual violence, right? But I would also like to include maybe even just violence in general. I think physical violence, I think that there is as well. And people have come out recently to talk about this. And maybe you can share with us what your experience there was, what you witnessed, or anything personal, or even just the culture that you had, the sentiment, the feeling of other fellow servicemen in the military.
I guess I didn't see too much culture of violence. I guess I just feel like it's on the decline. I feel like it has been a lot worse in the past. People would get in fights a lot more back in the day, and it's just it's a much more punishable offense, you know, to assault somebody physically. It's just, you know, so much has changed in the military. You used to be able to smoke everywhere, and now you can't smoke. And it's like, yeah, people are lamenting the kindler, gentler Navy. I think that's Bill Clinton's term, but it's really true. It is a kindler, gentler Navy, and I'm sure that there are sexual assaults happening more in the military than elsewhere, but And I don't want to downplay that. I think it's, you know, one is too many. But I do think that the culture of the military, I do think that military is probably being more proactive about it than the rest of society. I think just the fact that you're fighting an uphill battle with the culture of the military, I guess. And the fact that people are living together. I mean, you know, you're living on the same ship for months at a time, or you're deployed and people have PTSD and stuff like that. So you're dealing with all kinds of factors that you do not have outside the military. So, I mean, the problem is greater in the military for just so many different reasons. But yeah, so that, as far as violence, I just say it's getting better, thankfully. And that's probably true of society in general. Actually, I don't know if that's true. Society kind of feels like it's getting more violent. It's like, now we have UFC and stuff like that. You know, it's like they're playing, showing UFC in restaurants now. It's like it's this normal thing for people to be getting their face beaten in while you're eating. But yeah, I don't know. I think the military is getting better. Like, I wouldn't tell my kids to join. I wouldn't want them to join the military. But I guess that's also because I'm financially secure.
We're about to speak before about either an anecdote around sexual harassment or something like that. Is that something that you have to do?
Yeah. Yeah, so my first 6 months as an officer, just a bit of background, I went from an E5 to an O1 and basically skipped a whole bunch of ranks in between. Never had a supervisory role, really. And here I was in charge of ranks that previously were in charge of me, with several steps in between. And so it was like I was having trouble figuring out how to relate to everybody. You know, like before, when I'd call somebody chief, that meant my boss. And now when I call him chief, that meant my subordinate. And that was just really weird for me in a way that I don't think was weird for, you know, people who had gone straight from college to the Naval Academy to the Navy. And so I was relating to junior enlisted in sort of a more an informal way, I guess. And so I would, and there was also the context of supervisors who were acting kind of tyrannic, and they were unpopular. So I was also trying to talk to the junior enlisted to get a sense of what was going on, like what was really going on, because I had this filter between me and the rank and file that, you know, I was only getting one. And so anyway, so I developed sort of an informal relationship with a lot of the sailors, and one woman, one young woman, maybe 21, 22, would frequently talk to me about random stuff, just strike up conversations. And yeah, so one day my this young woman came up to me, and just like in normal in the course of a conversation, mentioned that her supervisor had, you know, been making inappropriate remarks, and I can't even remember the details. But it didn't send up any red flags for me. Partly because I wasn't really trained to deal with this situation, and I just wasn't ready for it. And later it came out that she had attempted to tell me about her boss sexually harassing her. And I felt terrible, not because I got in trouble for it, for not addressing it, but because she had tried to tell me and I didn't do anything about it. Just because it hadn't occurred to me that this was something I needed to address. And so I guess that was a kind of a personal anecdote about sexual harassment in the Navy. the guy ended up getting transferred. You know, he was demoted and transferred to another ship. And yeah, so sexual harassment, you know, by supervisors, definitely a problem. And I saw it when I was enlisted too, although it was a lot different. I would say it was my leading petty officer, I would say, took advantage of one of the sailors. There was a young woman of Indian, or actually she was from Fiji, but like first generation immigrant, I think. And she was in danger because her ex-husband, or boyfriend, I can't remember which, was basically threatening her, and she needed an escort to her car every day. And our LPO, the supervisor, the sort of the main supervisor in our division, took that responsibility of walking her to her car every day. And over time, this went on for several weeks, and they ended up, you know, he ended up driving her home on times. And so there was this growing sort of relationship with them that was, you know, inappropriate. Not in terms of like lack of consent, but in terms of just the fraternization piece. Anyway, so you never know how much of that is, you know, taking advantage of somebody and how much of that is consensual. I mean, I guess it's up to the person involved, but it ended up not working out very well for either of them. So yeah, that's not really sexual harassment though. It's just fraternization.
That is a story. I think I'd like to include it. That's actually in the workplace as well. Those questions come up. So I think.
Yeah.
I appreciate that it's, you know, it's not some glamorization. It's like a real story. It's a real thing that happened.
Yeah, and the story gets a little more interesting too because people started resenting it. I don't exactly know why. I think there was partly jealousy of the supervisor, maybe partly jealousy of her. I don't know. But we ended up, we were talking about it because it was getting really like almost open relationship type of thing. And one of the guys sent an anonymous email to the supervisor basically saying, you know, we know what you guys are doing. You need to stop. And the supervisor went straight to his supervisor, told him everything, denied any relationship, and we all got called in. Each one of us got called in one by one into the office to basically be told that we hadn't seen anything. It was a misunderstanding, and we need to basically not be part of the rumor mill.
Perpetuate you.
So it was kind of a strange case of, I guess, like collective action, but not really a worthy cause.
Well, honestly, I want to kind of wrap up a little bit here because we have more to talk about. Maybe we've actually spent most of our time on basic, in your basic time. I will finalize with this because I would like to ask you this question. Because I think next time we'll talk more a little bit about the officer experience, and we want to center it around you had some experiences on missions that you had mentioned that we want to talk about, and then I think some deeper questions about politics that come
2009
up.
2009 Yemen,
yeah,
etc.
Tomahawk stuff or whatever. My last question really is, so basic training is actually famous in movies, you know, like a Full Metal Jacket. You know, stripes, you know, it's like you have these people right up in your face yelling and all sorts of things get said. And even like you said, physical, what parts of those things ring true? What parts of them don't? And I understand the notion of feeling, what do you make now of that whole experience for yourself in terms of what it meant for who you are today?
Yeah, that's a great question. Basic training is like It's important because it's the sort of everyone's indoctrination into the Navy, so or the military, so it's a common kind of ground. It's like a tone setting thing, like this is how our culture is going to be. And I think it's really important for that reason, and a lot of, you know, time and energy is invested into it for that reason. And, you know, like I was saying earlier, it's basically a form of hazing. It's not like, you know, you're not just going to learn skills and you're not going just to learn, but to learn behavior patterns, I guess, destructive behavior patterns. But anyway, yeah, I would say Full Metal Jacket was extremely realistic, at least that first part, in the boot camp part. Like, I think Harley Ermey, the actor who played the drill sergeant, was actually a drill sergeant.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was extremely realistic. It's pretty impressive, honestly. I mean, you spend an entire year before you become a recruit division commander, which is the equivalent of the drill instructor, just kind of learning the trade of yelling at people. And it's an act, you know. You have, I think that they kind of develop a sort of a repertoire of insults to throw at people. And yeah, after a while, you learn that it's an act and you start hearing things get repeated and it's like, okay. But at first, it's extremely impressive. It's like, holy shit, like, what's going on? Like, you're just completely disoriented and humiliated. And the idea is that they want to break you down and build you up into something new. Just completely break you down, like, you know, spiritually and physically. And that's basically what they do. And if they detect any sort of resistance in that, they'll keep pushing. So you learn to kind of show their act that you're sort of humiliated and fearful, because if you appear not to be, then they'll keep like trying to press your buttons, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's mostly just hazing. You know, you hardly ever get to call home, sleep deprivation. And I liked the idea of it, but I remember towards the end, I remember telling my mom how tired I was of boot camp and how ready I was to leave. But I really liked the idea. Like, I wanted to be toughened up, you know. And looking back on it, I think it's just a terrible thing to wish on yourself or on anybody. But yeah, it makes you feel like a Superman, I guess, when you go through that and you make it through to the other side. But it's silly. I think the only thing that's changed from Full Metal Jacket is the hitting part. Although there might be more that's changed since I left. I think they're not depriving people of sleep anymore. I think I heard something about requiring 8 hours of sleep now, which I'm sure all the old salty guys are lamenting, but I think it's definitely for the better. It's a lot more rational.
You just, maybe I'm trying to pull something out here, but I guess I was referring, when I was talking about hazing and fraternity, I was referring more to not the culture of having supervisors do that to the rest of the seamen. I was talking about within the sailors themselves, if they had groups of fraternity, like, you know, they would have, you know, who's part of the in crowd and who's part of the out crowd. And if you wanted to be part of the in crowd, did you have to have some sort of, you know, I don't know, beating up or something, or even if there is some, like, you know, like you have in colleges, you have a, you have these fraternities, and they have different kinds of hazings there. I'm not sure if that still is going on in amongst the seamen.
Yeah, no, I don't. At least I didn't take note of much of that. I'd say people are generally pretty respectful. Well, that might be overstating it. I mean, people push each other's buttons and whatnot, and you know, just there's macho culture, you know, like, or I don't know if I'd call it macho culture, but just like people want to kind of like push your buttons and see what you're made of, I guess. But you know, I guess after a while, you kind of you learn to get along, and I became very close with a lot of the people in my division. We became very good friends. I've never had friendships so close as I did, you know, during those enlisted years, either before or after. You know, that I think that's probably one thing that I learned in the Navy was just the value of friendship. And you know, you spend hours upon hours standing watch with people, and you have nothing to do but to talk, and you end up talking about everything. And you really like get a, it gives you such a good sense of what it means to be human, I guess, because you're constantly rubbing shoulders with people from completely different backgrounds and talking about all kinds of things from people totally different from you. So, but I didn't see too much of that. I'd say the hazing part is just, is the formal part.
Yeah.
But as far as the, you know, among the rank and file, it's, people are much more respectful, I think.
It's interesting you say that because you normally see it in prison culture. You see like this gang mentality. You see it in college culture. You see it in high school culture.
Yeah.
There is, you know, the people will haze or do something to the freshmen, the incoming freshmen, or in gangs, you know, to be a part of a group, they'll do something to be a part of the group, or in college. So I'm curious how maybe you didn't experience it the first time. Maybe I'm just basing it off of other people's experiences that I have heard of. But that's interesting. So thank you for sharing with me.
Then maybe the last one is, today is Veterans Day.
Today's Sunday?
Today. Oh, no, tomorrow. Tomorrow's Veterans Day.
Oh, tomorrow.
Yeah. And this, I guess we'll end on this, and then we'll wrap up and do the next episode with you, Will. So you were in the military, but you're today a revolutionary socialist. What does Veterans Day mean for you now?
For me, it's, I guess sometimes I post something on Facebook just kind of like talking about my experience. And because, you know, a lot of times when I show my military ID or something for a benefit or, you know, I mentioned that I was part of the military, people will say, thank you for your service. And I never know quite how to respond because I know that a lot of times they're just saying it because it's like an obligation and they're not saying it like genuinely, but a lot of times people say it genuinely and, you know, it's like saying, you know, it's just a nicety, you know? So, but sometimes I say, you know, it wasn't a service. It was just a job. And sometimes if I'm feeling really, you know, angry about things and I'll say, you know, we spend a lot of time bombing innocent people and I don't see it as a service at all, you know, but, normally, you know, talking to strangers, it's just, it's not even worth it. They look at you like you're crazy if you say something like that. So normally I just say thank you and just leave it at that. You know, it's hard to know how to deal with that, but, yeah, so it doesn't mean anything to me, I guess. I think most veterans are, you know, a lot further to the left than probably people realize. So it'd be good to maybe have, I mean, I know there's Iraq veterans against the war, just like Vietnam veterans against the war, and I'm glad there are groups like that. Veterans for Peace. To me, that's the sort of veteran that I identify with, the anti-war veteran.
Well,
not the veteran that thinks they should be thanked.
Right. Like the winter soldiers of the Vietnam era. I guess I will say this, though, because I do believe people mean it. In the same way that people, when I say I'm a school teacher, public school teacher, people will thank me, and they're sincere. And I actually really do believe people are very sincere in being like, thank you for your service. I'll bet you they're as sincere in saying that as they are about thanking me for my service. And I want to come back to what your mom was saying. You know, in her time, and this was good that this was like that, people were critical of the military. People were not, you don't want your sons or daughters going into the military because this is a war machine of death and cruelty. And a lot of ground has been regained by the U.S. ruling class in getting the rest of us to not think that way of our military any longer. Yet our military is more that than it ever has been. Even though it's compartmentalized and it's almost like a Terminator 2 kind of machine, where it's as much mechanized and automated as it is people killing directly. I think those that sentiment is sincere, but it does speak to the ground that the U.S. ruling class has gained on the working class on their imperial project within this country, that people do say thank you for your service. And with that, it's not to say they're not going to. It's not to say spit on. It would be to say, hey, it would be more to say, I am sorry that you had to be part, or that you chose even to, or had to be part, or chose to be part of the U.S. killing machine, because it used to be more like that, right after Vietnam, and they have gained ground since that time.
Yeah, I think that's true. I will say that people of color are much less likely to say it, which I appreciate. I feel like they understand a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Well, thank you, Will. I think we'll wrap it up from here, and we look forward to a next interview with you again. Let's conclude this episode. It's a long episode.
And just to say that the next, like we have questions that run more deeply into, some of the actual things you experienced while on tour. On one of your tour duties, but also we have other political questions that range from WikiLeaks to how do we build an actual anti-war movement in the United States and things like that. So if people who are listening, if you're interested in this, there's a lot more ground to be covered. So hopefully you'll stay with us on interview number 3. We're going to run out of thumbnails for you on this stuff.
Thank you, Will. And
thank you guys for having me once again.
Let's conclude. So for our viewers and listeners, anyone that is new, you can check us out on any of our 5 platforms on BitChute, Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes Podcasts, or YouTube. Please subscribe, rate, review, and best of all, share with your family and community. And we look forward to next week. Thank you, Will, very
Thanks,
much.
Will.
Thank
all
you.
Right. See you next week.
Ciao.
All right. Thank you.
I just want to say a few things.
Yeah.
Well, I want to make sure that when you say any of the things that you're going to say, you keep in mind that this is going to be public. I know that sounds silly of me telling you that, because it's obviously going on YouTube, and you know that, but somehow I just have a sense that some of these things are very sensitive issues, and I'm not sure how much you want to say, and it's up to you and up to your discretion. Just, I don't know. I guess I'm very paranoid about the military and the deep state, the establishment, and surveillance. So I want you to, as you answer some of these questions, just to be mindful. Even some of the things you had said in the last interview when you had said about an insurgency, I cringed a bit, thinking that you would possibly get sought after
in Leavenworth.
Yeah.
So this is just my final warning to tell you.
Why are you canceling the interview right now?
He has a family. I never think were you. You know, just to be mindful.
No, yeah. That's...
And
yeah,
and
yeah. No, I appreciate that.
And I will echo that. I will echo that, but remind you that this is not a live stream. This is a recording.
This is true.
And I would urge you to maybe go towards being a little bolder with what you say, and you and your wife pull it back later. Remember, this episode won't be coming out at least a week after the one we hope is, I think it's either this week or next week, where Will Part 1 comes up. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if this is a three-parter.
Okay. Yeah, I don't imagine that... I mean, I think this one will be easier for me than probably the other one, because it's more straightforward.
Yeah.
So.
But I'm. You understand where I'm coming from, right, Will?
Oh, totally.
All right.
Totally.
But again,
yeah, that's good.
We're
that's
maybe
good
just
advice.
Being redundant here. Just be free, and you have access to the entire thing afterwards.
Right. Right.